amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show. I'm Steve W. I'm here with Steve D this week. And since Get Paul Out is trending on Twitter, he's not here at the moment. But we've got plenty of things that have been going on this week. Interest rates in the UK have decided to level off for a little bit, although they're not coming down till 2025. Shell reported earnings that were much stronger than BP's. They reported some slightly dodgy ones earlier, and Shell have come in much higher than that. And we've got some requests for us to have a look at Reckitt and NatWest from the UK markets. But we don't have time for any of those things this week. Probably in some cases, no weeks. But we will get to the Reckitt stuff and the NatWest stuff in future. We've started work on those already. And having a read and having a think and having a bit of a process before we report back on what we've got. But we do have lots of other interesting things. Things that have been going on this week. Like important things in the life of Steve D. Steve, what's been going on this week for you?
It's been another slow week at work. I feel like this is something I could probably just auto record and just slap in the edit at some point. There has been more stuff to do this week than previously, so that's a bonus, Steve. But I mean, what a week in the market we've had! It's been very, very strong for me. I mean, we were just checking off there, and the S&P's up just over 4%, Nasdaq somewhere near that as well. But I'm up 5.43%, Steve. So it's been very, very good for me. I would have been up even more if Fortinet hadn't decided to shit the bed and drop 20% on Friday, which to me, I still think is an opportunity. I read through that report and I really didn't see anything there other than the sort of standard market reaction to somebody saying, I think guidance is going to be a little bit lower for a month or so before we return back to reasonable growth. So I actually bought Fortinet. I bought it straight away when it was 20% down. It finished the day only 12% down. So I guess that's a minor win of sorts. I'm actually only something like 6 or 7% down on that position now. So, and I've been able to add 33% to it, which is a bit of an acquirer's dream, I think. We've also read through the Four Corners report. It's a really interesting report for a REIT. We've got a couple of REITs on today that we'll be talking about. I like that one too, Steve. So I bought a little bit more of that. So three purchases for me this week to round it off. Fortinet, I added about 33% to my position. Four Corners, I added about 10% to my position. And I put £600 into Enphase, Steve, which has got off to a roaring start as well this week. It's up about 6% on my purchase price. So it's been a busy week for me. I'm quite comfortable where we are at the moment. Steve, how about you?
Nice to see someone doing well in Enphase for once. Someone's got to, right? Someone's got to be buying it at the bottom. Someone's got to be selling it at the top. But
I might be the only green investor in Enphase.
You might well be the only green investor at Enphase. Yeah, this is very impressive stuff. So yeah, busy then. Lots of things you're seeing at the moment, even though the UK's announcement this week that it's going to hold interest rates steady for the time being at 5.25% rather than continuing to increase them to battle inflation, kind of indicating maybe a shift from bringing down inflation as a priority to avoiding a recession stimulating growth to GDP, basically, as the new priority. That was pretty well received by markets. That dragged things higher by varying amounts, but the things that were hit harder by higher interest rates, so actually REITs in quite a few cases, sort of responded fairly well, both in the UK and elsewhere in the US as well. I saw property shares prices going up a fair bit there. I, like you, have had an up week in the market. They have to happen sometime, I guess, statistically anyway. But yeah, I'm up a touch over 5.5% this week, which I view as very strange feelings at the moment. I got used to the idea that things were down and going to stay down and there was no real end in sight to interest rate hikes and inflation battling and so on, because inflation's ticking up in the US and it's not anywhere near the Bank of England's target in the UK. There's still quite the way to go on that. So I was expecting more rates, more rate hikes and so on. but and therefore more buying opportunities. For the moment, though, things have just lifted off a little bit. I've been looking at primary health properties, which is a REIT we've talked about, I think, a couple of times on here now, at least once, certainly. I do own shares in that company. I've been buying shares recently. Those shares are now, I guess I would call them solidly green, because that had a bit of a lift towards the end of the week. And I'm trying to keep myself out of a situation of thinking, oh, this is now solidly green, that must be a case that I shouldn't buy it anymore then, because that doesn't automatically follow. If you zoom out a little bit and look at the 2-year chart, 1-year chart, something like that, what you see is a large downward slope with a tiny little ski jump thing at the end, which is, that puts things into perspective a little bit better here. So I bought some things earlier in the week, probably that, I think also some Forterra, which is also now in the invest account where I bought that, is solidly green. In the ISA, where I own most of my invested stuff, is even more solidly red. There's no point tax loss harvesting out of an ISA, but that's one where I have very green on one side and very red on the other, and it's hard to not feel different about buying them in different accounts. And I also brought Kraft Heinz, which is up a little bit since then, before its earnings. We'll come back to some of those stocks in a little bit, though. But anything interesting been happening outside the stock market, Steve? I think I saw a picture of your bedroom on Twitter earlier.
It is an interesting story, that, Steve, of some description, because I had to basically, we ordered a new bed because we've been in a small double for a while, and we're at the moment two large people, because my wife is 8 months pregnant now, so
2.5
there or thereabouts. Steve, I'm not that fat. But
so your
basically,
wife.
new bed came, and we. Basically, yeah, I had to throw it together and put it in the room, take the old bed down, and then we were planning on giving the old bed away to charity. It was an oak frame bed, so it's a nice bed. Wife decided that she would sooner keep the bed that we have and give away the other bed. So I ended up having to take down the spare bed, put the other bed up in the spare room, and then she decided that her mother would actually quite like the old bed frame, so I then had to take the bed to her mother's and put that up as well. So I ended up doing 3 beds in a day, Steve. It was quite arduous. The first night we got it, Steve, we didn't get a mattress, so I had to make myself a little crash mat out of cushions because I rolled off the edge. And but yeah, we are all done now. The UPS man brought the new mattress. It was one of those ones that's vacuum packed.
Mm-hmm.
Mattress, and I watched him on the ring struggle to carry it down the drive, and I thought to myself, what a weakling. Do you know what I mean? Like, how are you a courier if you can't even carry a mattress down the drive in a box? Anyway, he put it on my doorstep, and I went out there like the man I am to pick it up and just show him how easy it was. I bent down, Steve, at the knees, obviously, wrapped my arms around it, went to go lift it, and nothing happened. It was the heaviest mattress I have ever felt in my life. But yes, I did get it in on my own. I did get it upstairs, and then I laid on the couch for about 3 hours, nursing a very sore back. But yeah, how's your week been, Steve, in that regard? Anything more exciting than that?
Well, I was going to say that actually, since our last show, I have now completed my level 2 cricket coaching qualification. So for the last month or so, I've been doing the level 2. It's been really good. I've enjoyed it very, very much. But let's bin that story for a moment. I'll tell you about last week when a new mattress arrived at our house for Alistair, in this case, our little one. He's moving off of his kind of cot mattress. So he sleeps, quote unquote, on the floor, on a mattress on the floor, by which I mean not in a cot. When I say on the floor, we don't just be like, there you go. I mean, sometimes he sleeps on the floor because he rolls off it and just gets comfy where he is. But by design, he sleeps on a mattress. So he's a floor bed type baby. We found that easier because he never really liked being lowered into a cot for reasons that were not entirely obvious to either me or my wife. But a mattress arrived for him. That one's a small double. And they gave me a choice on the delivery thing of, would you like to pay an extra 17 quid, in which case we'll take it upstairs for you? And I said no. And I thought that meant they would like leave it somewhere downstairs in the hallway or whatever. Because when we had a wardrobe delivered, they did that. They stuck it all in the living room and then let us take it upstairs. Fine-ish. But no, this guy just brought it to the doorway, dropped it in the doorway and left. Said cheers, see you later. So I can lift a small double, which is what that mattress was, and they're quite significantly smaller than the Is Super King, are you in now? Okay.
Yeah, we're in the Super King, yeah.
Got you. Yeah, so that is significantly heavier than what we were trying to lift. And I did manage to get that up into Alice's room. He's now very happy in there. More importantly, and it wasn't really for him, so are the people that are trying to co-sleep with him, which is me sometimes and my wife most of the time. So we're also having a very nice time on a mattress but no bed. So very much the opposite way round to your setup. Anyway, exciting stories about mattresses and beds left to one side for the moment. And indeed, cricket badges. We'll come back to those maybe in some future weeks because everyone loves it when we do this. Steve, what have you consumed this week?
So I have consumed a podcast that we've discussed quite a few times before. It's the Merrin Talks Money Show. We've said sometimes it's good to listen to people you disagree with, and that was definitely a case this week because they had Cathie Wood on the show, Steve. And I was just saying to you off air, it's strange how stock performance sort of affects your thinking of their thinking, I guess is what I'm going to say here. So when Cathie was absolutely smashing the market to pieces and all of her stocks were doing very, very well and she couldn't pick a loser, I guess there was an element of having to just believe her at face value because she evidently knows what she's doing. And now the opposite is totally, totally true of this and realizing my own biases here. She sounds like an absolute raving lunatic on this show. She's talking about inflation from World War One, 1911, which obviously is impossible to compare because back then we were on the gold standard and now we're so far removed from the gold standard. It's incredible. And it just seems to be sort of jam-packed full of very strange thoughts and conspiracies and wishings of somebody who is failing miserably in the market. Well, we say failing miserably in the market, Steve. She's failing miserably in terms of share price, but for whatever reason, investors don't seem to be withdrawing their money from her. They just keep piling it in. And you look through that portfolio, the flagship innovation fund, Steve, and it is dire. The stocks in there are absolutely dire. If we have a 5% interest rate for any sort of rate of time, and I mean, Cathy's talking about was going through massive periods of high, even talking about double-digit deflation now is what she thinks we're heading towards. The stocks in that portfolio are not going to fare well. So if the things that she is talking about in that podcast performance are what she actually believes, her portfolio is not geared up to weather that. So it's crazy to me that that this is the kind of mentality that she's got, and the disconnect between what she thinks and what she buys is very strange to me, Steve. So I would recommend you listen to it, but maybe you know, you might be as well just walking down the street and finding that crazy woman who throws cats at you when you walk by, because I think she's talking as much sense, Steve.
It's interesting at the moment. It's an interesting time to be Cathie Wood. I sort of feel like at the moment it's very difficult to say anything much if you're Cathie Wood at the moment, because I think realistically people are going to struggle to take you terribly seriously right now. There was a time when you could do no wrong and you appeared to just be explaining everything around you, and that was your investment thesis. And she never really made much of the idea of rates are at zero, although she was pushed a couple of times specifically on the question of interest rates, in which she gave some answers that were, with hindsight, and I want to say they probably should have been seeable with foresight as well, but certainly with hindsight, which is 2020, wrong. She thought there was going to be one rate hike in the US. There was not. There were loads of rate hikes, and a lot of them were double ones. So her kind of idea of we're going to do well over the next few years because interest rates are not going up that much, deflation will bring inflation under control without the Fed having to do anything. Well, whatever you think of deflation, she's clearly wrong on where interest rates were going. And to your point, Steve, she has a portfolio that looks like one cold winter, and you start worrying about a lot of these. So any kind of extended 5% thing and things start running out of cash quite quickly. What I will say, you flag the point that it's mostly just share prices going down of the stuff that she owns rather than investors getting scared and running for the hills. If there was a time when you wanted to buy Cathie Wood style stocks, it's probably now rather than sort of 3 years ago, or even 2.5 years ago, when these things were about four times where they are at the moment. That was clearly an act of lunacy. And she was still saying, obviously, these things are in deep value territory for where they may be in the future. And I think in most cases, that's going to turn out to be false. But at the moment, rates are topping roughly where they are. If you can find these companies, get through, if things, there's a chance that things will pan out for at least some of them. And she's a big ETF thing. So it's not a case that these are all going to be winners, and you don't need them all to be winners. A couple of these win very big and you're away. But it's hard at the moment being Cathie Wood, and that, I mean, there was a time where you couldn't do anything wrong, and it feels like now there's a time where you can't do anything right. She made a big play about this judge us on our 5-year track record thing when things started turning around a little bit. That 5-year track record doesn't look wonderful at the moment. Over the last 5 years, the S&P 500 is up 57%. The NASDAQ, which is maybe the more relevant index, because in some ways ARK sees itself as displacing the NASDAQ as a kind of innovative tech sort of thing, which Cathie is quite right, actually. If, in the case of the NASDAQ, it's very, very heavily weighted towards its top end, which is the FANGs plus Tesla and NVIDIA. That's up 114% over the last 5 years. And if you bought ARK shares 5 years ago, you would be shares 5 years ago, you would be down 9%. So if you look at the kind of track record of the last 5 years, as Cathie often wanted you to, it's miserable. I mean, it's really, really miserable. If you think there's good value here, if you think you believe some of this stuff, which seems increasingly harder to swallow in an environment where it costs you 5%+ to finance your business, then now is the time, I think, if it ever was.
So now, Steve, the problem I've got with ARK's portfolio is before it had winners in there. There was companies that you could look at and say, look, she picked Tesla here at this and this here and this that. And if, like me, you believe Tesla's now fairly fully valued, you look at the rest of that portfolio and just chop Tesla out at the top there and say, this portfolio is just full of crap. Do you know what I mean? It's like Tesla and then having like a Russell 2000 ETF in there is essentially what I think the rest of that portfolio is. Even if there's a Russell 2000 version that excludes the profitable companies, that's probably what that ETF is. So you look down at that and it's just awful. There was a time when me and you would look through that portfolio and we'd look at, you know, the Teslas and the Illuminas and the companies like that. And I think Meta was in there for a period of time and Nvidia was in there for a period of time. And you saw this was a really heavy tech focused ETF or fund that you thought, hey, there's some quality here. Yes, there's a lot of other bets, like what Google does and like what Amazon do. There's a lot of other bets, but the core of this portfolio is really, really good. And now you look down at it and it's like Tesla and it's like Zoom, which is just dead. There's Teladoc in there, which has died. She must be so far down on Teladoc because she was buying this and Livongo in the really high hundreds, maybe 200 kind of range for Livongo. And I think Teladoc, when I looked at it last time, was $18. It's a massive monumental fall. So, but then you look at, like, this is a lady who's supposed to be, she's supposed to, you know, have a magnifying glass to look at the future, and she's missed out on Nvidia by selling it, the company that has brought, well, huge earnings to people this year by being at the forefront of AI. And it's not in Cathie's portfolio. She's not got Microsoft. She's not got Google. These are all missing from the AI and cloud side of her portfolio. These are all the trends that if you wanted Cathie to be running a portfolio for, these are the trends that you'd want her to pick for you. What's left in this portfolio to me seems like somebody desperately gambling on biotech penny stocks to try and make back the money that she's lost, and that's a really sad turn of events.
Yeah, that's not where you want to be, is it? like quite a few fund managers, there's sort of two things going on, I guess. If you compare, as people often do, even though they are entirely different, Cathie Wood and Warren Buffett for the time being, both of them appear to have almost a kind of, and Cathie's done very well in Tesla and Buffett's done very well in Apple, and there's no arguing with, I think, either of those two points, but both do have a horrible knack buy and sell things at the wrong time for any given stock. So Cathy would correctly lined up Nvidia beforehand and was early on that, but early in a good way, right? Early before it started going on a mad run. But then managed to buy and sell it at all the wrong times, which must be kind of infuriating. If all you had to do was sit still for a bit, and you would have done so much better than if you'd actually done any of this kind of active stuff. The activity here is killing them. And you can make the same point, by the way. I attempt to be as even-handed as I can. Berkshire appears to have got itself, with a couple of exceptions, both on the buying side and the selling side, in and out of Activision Blizzard at almost exactly the wrong moment. They did buy it before the kind of Microsoft stuff, or some of the Microsoft stuff, was announced. They've certainly bought it since then, though. And then they certainly sold part of it, although I don't think it's all of it, when it looked like that deal wasn't going through because of UK regulators. Now it looks like it is again, and the share price is back up. And they appear to have been basically on the wrong side of nearly everything at that moment, as has Cathy Wood. So I guess there's sort of two things going on here, right? One is you need to have that real vision going forward, and the other is you then need to pay attention and sit the hell still. And that's actually something that you know, better investors, and it's not an insult to say that I think Buffett is a better investor than Cathy Wood is. I think Buffett's a better investor than sort of nearly most people is, but it's not an insult to say that even kind of better ones than Cathy get this wrong too. But it must be infuriating for Cathy Wood to watch things like the AI stuff running off into the distance and saying, well, not only is that not stuff we own, it's stuff that we did own. They kind of owned all of this stuff for the right reasons as well, of thinking Microsoft is going to be cloud relevant. Google has a massive, powerful search engine thing. Meta has, well, Meta they thought of as a metaverse thing, but nonetheless, it's clearly a relevant and important and innovative business. They were in all this stuff. They were in all the innovation stuff. It's just that innovation appears to be mostly getting driven by, at least as far as the stock market is concerned, things that are big and powerful and have scale and strong balance sheets and cash available to do it, rather than being early stage loss making stuff. That's not a huge surprise. And even if you thought that was going to turn out false, if you were a kind of innovative, disruptive technologies thing, why wouldn't you at least cover that possibility by buying some of your portfolio in that?
It sort of reminds me of the new investor's portfolio, but in reverse. I think whenever people start a stock portfolio and they don't really know anything about stocks, the first thing they do is go hunting for information on like Reddit, or they go looking on Twitter or on stock twits and things like that, and they end up with a load of hot tips for crappy biotech companies that are like binary events, but they're 99.9% sure they're going to cure cancer, and then obviously the drug fails because the drug fails at 99.9% of these companies, and then the person who recommended it disappears or changes his name to a different stock, and that's kind of what, and then eventually people get out of this. They find that they lose £2,000, £3,000, £4,000 and think, hang on, this is stupid. And they end up with a portfolio that's probably Tesla, Nvidia, and high quality companies, and maybe some dividend stocks. And a proper portfolio is what I'm saying. But the exact opposite is what's happened at ARK. They've started with a proper portfolio and they've just trended towards absolute crap. And I just don't know. I think, Steve, like, if you were buying ARK 5 years ago when she was saying judges on your five-year portfolio, well, now you're looking at a huge loss. And she's collected fees every year for this as well. Mm-hmm. And this portfolio quality has deteriorated just massively. But acutely aware, Steve, we're spending far too much time on this. What have you consumed? Because we've got five stocks to do.
Yep, I can see the time going on as well here a bit. So I've been listening to Goldman Sachs as the exchanges again. They were having a kind of roundtable, but kind of more, I guess, multi-panelist discussion on the following question: is US outperformance now done, or basically a thing of the past? So it's been the case for some time that US stocks have comfortably outperformed. We focus on UK ones as comparison point, and it's true that US has outdone the UK in terms of stock market returns, but pretty much everywhere else as well, whether you think of Japan or China or Australia or anywhere, more or less the US has firmly well outperformed. That does tend to mean that US equity valuations, especially in the kind of anything connected to AI, which people think might be the future, tend to be significantly higher, let's say. We won't make a claim about whether they're fully valued or overvalued or undervalued for the moment, but they are, in relative terms, higher than other stocks that are around. So that leads us to the question then of, is this a thing of the past or is it not, this kind of big thing? And are we due a kind of correction? And they had some interesting points to make on there about what happens in different kind of market cycles and what's happened historically. Here's the kind of general take-home message, at least from the commentator that I was listening to. There's kind of things that move the market in the short term and there's things that move the market in the long term. You might paraphrase this into, market is a voting machine in the short term and a weighing machine in the long term. But what they kind of put it more in terms of, in sort of slightly less metaphorical speak, is the idea that what matters in the short term is multiples and how much investors are willing to pay for something. Earnings from year to year are going to move things slightly, sure. You might get, 10% growth out of a really good company for the moment. But that thing's PE going from 20 to 25 is going to move the number by more than its earnings going up by 10% or the other way in either case. So in the short term, what matters is multiples. In the longer term, what matters is growth and specifically earnings growth. We'll come back to this theme a little bit later. What they were suggesting is the US is actually pretty well placed if you think that what matters over the long term is earnings growth. Here are some reasons. One is they have a fairly supportive government that likes private industry and tends to be fairly accommodating of tech companies doing well and making new products and making loads of money off of new products. Second was, as I mentioned, they have a kind of big tech section to them, more so than other companies. And the third is that they really think there is stuff to be done here in AI. You can see it coming through from the big techs already. The bigs are likely to keep on winning here. So they were making a case for thinking that actually US is still the place to look for reasons that are partly distinctive to individual companies, which is roughly speaking AI as a reason, partly due to a supportive environment, which is to say a helpful government that doesn't going to overtax them particularly, and thirdly to do with the idea that what really matters is earnings growth over the long term rather than multiple expansion and compression. So okay, in the sort of, this is a line I've heard Buffett come out with before, by the way. So he's a big don't bet against America person. And some people want to paraphrase that idea or want to take an idea that's adjacent to that, which is, I'm not going to bet against America, i.e. I'm not about to go short in the S&P. But that doesn't mean I have to bet on America in any interesting way. Well, these guys think betting on America might well be the way to go going forward. And I thought that was interesting and thoughtful from them. I think the bit I'm most interested in is the bit that they're least interested in. It's their kind of background assumption here that over the long term, what is going to make the price of a share go higher? The answer is earnings growth. It's not just going to be the case that it's going to re-rate at a higher multiple forever. You may well think something's trading at a multiple that's too low, by the way, and when the market realizes this, it will close that multiple up. But that'll happen once. That won't happen on a kind of ongoing basis. If you think something should be trading at 18 times earnings and it's currently trading at 12 and a half or something, that gap will close if you're right, and it'll close to 18. And then what? The only thing that can make that go higher from there is 18 becoming, or 18 times earnings becoming a bigger number by the earnings going up. So I thought that was very interesting and very thoughtful. What do you think, Steve?
My only real point on this one is this has been quite a long running sort of thing over the last month and a bit, is that Dalio has been sending out his executives from Bridgewater to talk down the US, which is really talking his book. It's definitely not the first time I've seen this. I saw there was an article in, I think it was in Reuters, of a different investment strategist leaving Bridgewater to say that America is totally overvalued and that we should look elsewhere. And for me, this is quite a lot of Bridgewater talking their own book, talking their own investments, and trying to convince people to go with them with semi-smart arguments. So, not a huge... I mean, I'm not a fan of Ray Dalio in any way, shape or form. I think he's a nuisance. I always think the people who pretty much parrot his line, to me, he's a bit like what we were complaining about the other week, is that to work for Ray Dalio, you seem to have to parrot the party line. And I think I think that's essentially what is happening here. I think a lot of people have come out with basically stuff that he's told them to say, because eventually that will improve the value of the hedge fund if people start to believe it. So yeah, expect a lot more Bridgewater people telling you to invest in other places that Ray Dalio quite likes and in America, which for some reason he doesn't, is my general thought on it.
Yeah, Dalio at the moment is kind of pro-China as his sort of big market, and partly because I think he's hoping to expand Bridgewater's presence there, and so talking up China and being nice to China is probably a good way of doing that. China obviously has pretty good scope for growth as well. What it doesn't have is a terribly supportive government of this sort of thing, which it's tougher to be a big tech company in China than it is in America. And people disagree backwards and forwards about whether the current difference in valuations of big tech in America versus big tech in China makes a difference on that. The line I was hearing was that in the short term, yeah, maybe. In the longer term, probably not, to be honest. In the longer term, being able to grow better will grow you into your multiple. You may have to be patient for that, though. And with interest rates at 5%, there's arguably more growing that needs to be done, and it becomes that bit harder to do it. But over time, growth beats value, I guess, is the kind of line I'm thinking of there. Although I think quite a few people would balk at both sides of that, of growth as being thought of as growth at any price, and value being thought of as excluding growth, or something like that. Anyway, should we talk about some actual stocks, Steve? We're halfway through the show. Let's talk about something that people actually want to listen to, not just your and my bed activities. Right. Before we move on, a quick one from Steve and me. If you're enjoying the show, please do give us a like, a comment, and a rating on whatever platform you're listening on. And make sure you share the podcast with your investing friends. It helps us a lot, and we're really looking forward to building out something that you guys can get some value from and that we can have some fun in making. So do like, subscribe, and back on with the show.
The sucker's going up.
Apple, to start off with, then. They reported their earnings on Thursday, and the stock did not respond terribly well in aftermarket trading. It fell by about 3%. Friday was a decent day in markets, so actually it kind of came back to more or less where it was before. It went down 3%, back to 0.5% down on the by the end of the day. That's against the context of a broader market that was moving higher, though. So what was not to like? Revenue came in at $89.5 billion for the quarter. That's compared to $90 billion from what we would call Q3 and what they would call Q4 a year before that. So I guess you probably call that flat, within 1%. So let's say flat for the moment. Earnings per share were not flat. They were $1.47, which was quite significantly higher than they were a year ago. And that's something we've seen from quite a few tech, big tech companies at the moment. So if your revenues are roughly similar and your profits are higher, that means your margins must have gone up. And in the case of places like Meta, especially Meta being a very good example of this, but others as well, what we've seen is, largely speaking, costs coming out of the business, which is shorthand for sacking everybody, and margins going higher and earnings going higher, even though, or earnings growth outstripping revenue growth, I guess, is a better way of putting it. But that's not the case at Apple, because they haven't been sacking everybody. And the reason they haven't been sacking everybody is because they never hired everybody in the first place. They tend to keep their workforce at a much more steady level here. So why are these margins going up? Well, two reasons. Let's start with the bigger reason for the moment here. Their services business, which is a 70% gross margin business as opposed to a sort of 35% gross margin business that they get from flogging products, revenues in there went up 16%. So if you think revenues are flat overall and what you are getting is a better mix in terms of margins, so 16% more in services and a corresponding drop in product revenues, that will make their margins go higher. Here on the product side, the iPhone had pretty good revenue numbers, I think, and everything else was rubbish and through the floor. The other reason that earnings were higher, or earnings per share, sorry, were higher, even though that makes earnings in general higher, earnings per share were higher because partly buybacks. So over the last year, taking the end of the last, I'm going to keep calling them Q3 for the moment, to this Q3, their share count's gone down from 16.1 million to 15.7 million. So even if you had the same earnings, you'd be spreading that across a smaller number of shares outstanding, meaning higher earnings per share for everyone. The big downer on this, so why the hell did things go down? Well, one reason is that the stock's trading at a PE multiple, or it was at the start of the day anyway, probably is now, to be honest, of around 29 or high 20s is where it was. And it's an interesting proposition for an investor to think, yeah, I'm going to own this thing at 29 times earnings and next year's revenue, the revenue we've just seen was flat year over year. Next quarter, they're also guiding for flat year over year. That was below what analysts were expecting. So we've had a flat, let's call it July to September quarter, a flat last quarter of the calendar year, and I want to buy this thing at 30 times earnings. For that to make sense, I think that can make sense. I don't think it does. It can make sense if you think margins are going to keep expanding, because you will get better earnings coming through, and it doesn't have to come out of the top line. I think this is where a lot of people kind of miss things. Top line definitely helps. If you want to try and make more money at the bottom line, it definitely helps be pulling more in at the top end of the business. But if you think that mix is going to go better from services versus products and margins are going to go higher, you will find profitability goes up even if the revenue doesn't move. It's quite a lot to do that from 27 earnings, but that's, I guess, a possible angle you might take here if you were positive or if you're trying to figure out why the stock didn't really go even lower than that, to be honest. I have some other thoughts here, Steve, but over to you. What did you make of this report?
So this was a strange report, really, in that when we talk about, say, just for argument's sake, when we were talking about something like Deckers, and we were saying that Hoka is growing at a rapid speed, Hoka One One, as I've heard it's now pronounced, and we called it 1-1. We said that if they can keep Oak at a similar sort of level or growing very slowly, 1, 2, 3, 4%, something like that, and then eventually Hoka will come along and it will drive the needle forwards. And that's essentially what we're seeing with Apple's services revenue. Apple's services revenue is now $22.3 billion. It's an absolute monster. It's still growing at 16%. That should come along and that should push the needle for them. The difference being that Mac was down 34% this quarter and iPad was down 10% and accessories were down 3%. So they're not static. They're falling quite considerably. And I think that is just as simple as this is a higher interest rate product. We've seen across a number of businesses that when it is something that you just go and pick off the shelf, like a pot of jam, it doesn't really matter how much they lift the price by, because if somebody wants jam, they're going to go and buy it. But when it's something that somebody has to finance, like Mac is nowadays because they're so expensive, and like an iPad probably is, it doesn't get purchased as much when the interest rates are at 5%. So these are interest rate sensitive products, which shouldn't shock anybody because they've got a high ticket price. And that's generally what I thought I saw. Looking through the report, it's very much single digits everything, apart from operating cash flow, which was down 10%, which would need a little bit of investigating. Product revenue as a whole was down 5%, but services revenue was up 16%. So eventually services will come along and support product revenue. That's why you're not seeing massive declines in overall revenues, that services revenue is so big and growing so fast. And I guess that's where you see the next leg of growth from, Steve, is that you're looking for product revenue to return to where it was and for services revenue to continue growing somewhere near the speed it is. And then eventually Apple will sort of chug along to its next leg of growth. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting business here. I'm not massively sure I'd be rushing out to buy it today, Steve. I think this report was weak in places and strong in others, but I don't see how it eventually gets to that multiple. I don't see where I get my value from this 20. It can't stay at 29 forever. A 29 multiple forever. I don't see why people would accept that. I think aggressive buybacks, some growth, maybe could sustain a 20, 22 and a half. Sort of PE or some kind of description. It is a premium business with a huge moat, but 29 just seems a lot, Steve. It seems a lot, especially in this market, it seems a lot to be paying for something that is as interest rate sensitive as this and doesn't have that next killer product that we were looking forward to. This product mix looks really quite stale all of a sudden, and the trick or treat thing that they did at the week, Tim Apple did in midweek, was just basically to announce a £1,500 Mac with 8 gig of RAM. Now, I appreciate that With a Mac, you'll do a lot more with 8 gig of RAM than you will with a PC. But it was $1,500 for an 8 gig. I mean, you'd be looking at, you could buy that off the shelf in Currys for a similar spec for a couple of hundred quid. So there's huge markup on that for no particular reason. Huge markup just for the software side of it alone, which you can either say you think it's worth it or not worth it. And I would lean towards saying it's almost definitely not worth it. So yeah, stale product mix, fast growing services, quite badly declining product revenue, quite interest rate sensitive. I don't think I would be interested in buying here, but I've never bought Apple, Steve. I've been selling it the minute Weeble have been giving it to me.
I have bought it before and do still own it, and I'm still significantly by my standards anyway, green on it. Your last point is the one that I think is the real important one here. So talking about, it's very difficult not to talk about the fact that your revenues haven't grown over the last 12 months, and then you're guiding for them to not do that again if you're a company like Apple. Luca Maestri put it down to tough comps. He actually said tough compares, but tough comps, which is the short version of tough compares. This speaks to a kind of bear argument that you and I were building, I think, sort of, let's say mid-pandemic, rather than the kind of early stuff of, okay, look, back to interest rates. This point is one of really low interest rates back then. So we were wondering, look, is everyone busy thinking, I'm going to buy an iPhone, I'm going to buy a Mac, I'm going to buy everything I can find. And if you helicopter money into people, and you don't make them go to work and it's quite hard to spend it, they'll buy a load of Apple gear. And that's not a terrific surprise to anybody. The gear's popular, expensive, and generally pretty good, I think. And so there was a real question of how much growth had got pulled forward by that point. And in the short term, over the last sort of 12 months or so, the answer looked like not an awful lot. With interest rates at 5%, we go from a free spending sort of area to a tougher spending sort of area. And yeah, all of a sudden product revenue starts slowing down here as people think, well, maybe I can get another year out of this Mac, or do I really need an iPad? Or all these questions I continue to ask myself, by the way, personally. So maybe in this case, what you're seeing is either the growth that was pulled forward now just spreading itself out back over this kind of period, or growth being kind of pushed forward, pushed back, as it were, for a kind of rainier day. That's the way they're presenting it. I agree with you, by the way, that I think the next leg up for growth here is product revenue to recover whenever spending kind of kicks off again, alongside some margin expansion from a growing services business. You didn't mention the buyback at first, and I think you're right not to, because Apple's excess cash for buybacks is winding down. It's not gone yet, and they're absolutely not in any danger with their financial position, but their kind of excess buyback gun is coming off a bit, so I wouldn't be relying on that too heavily for growth going forward. It'll still get you a bit, but I think the really exciting bit of when they said, okay, we're using all this extra cash to go and do buybacks, the excitement from that bit has now worn off to an extent. Over the long term, you mentioned the other day Piper Sandler, 87% of US teens have an iPhone, 88% expect their next phone to be an iPhone. It looks all right for the iPhone, doesn't it? It looks like everything else is getting pushed into the future. And you said they had quite a stale product mix. I would take a stale product mix rather than these stupid headset things they appear to be attempting to get themselves into developing. I don't think that's the next big winner for anybody, whether it's Apple, which I own, or Meta, which I don't, or anyone else for that matter. So I don't know whether that counts as talking my own book, yes or no, but I'm okay with the stale product mix if it means that we're going to stop trying to build out these implausibly expensive headset things or goggles or whatever it is we're busy doing here. So we think of Apple as a tech company, or on most kind of platforms and descriptors and ETFs and so on, it gets listed as a tech company. I think probably people should not. This behaves, as Buffett points out, much more like a consumer products company, and specifically a consumer cyclical products company. It sells expensive gear. I think of this much more like something like Polaris, which sells RVs. So when people have money to spend, yeah, they may well go and get involved in this. When that starts slowing down or becomes tougher, I expect things to come off. That's not what I expect from tech companies, which I expect to keep growing sort of fairly steadily through different macroeconomic environments, back to the Goldman point again. So I think of this as a consumer products company doing consumer products things. The time to buy them is when they're down. I'm not sure this one's really down, though it's a slowish period for earnings and revenue growth. But a 2% dip isn't really that much of a dip, Steve.
I think it was up more than that on the week in anticipation of the earnings, Steve, wasn't it? So I don't think it's down much at all. So,
fair enough.
Shall we move on to something that
did... Tell us about an actual tech company, Steve.
Oh, okay. So, again, I'll just quickly sort of caveat this, but I don't really like PayPal as a business, but it is a business that's all it's all about stats. So I've dug out a pile of stats here, so you'll have to bear with me as I shoot through them. And if any of the figures are or something are not completely clear to you, just ask us in the comments section what they mean, and we'll be happy to explain them. But total payment volume, so that's just payment through the network, $388 billion, that was plus 15%. Revenue was $7.4 billion, that's 8% up. Non-GAAP EBIT was $1.6 billion, plus 8%. The margin was 22%, which has actually dropped by 18 basis points. Non-GAAP net income, $1.4 billion, plus 14% year-on-year. Margin was 19%, that's plus 92 basis points. Op cash flow was $1.3 billion, 28% margin. Minus 28%. Sorry, margin was 17%. That's down 866 basis points. Free cash flow was $1.1 billion, which includes about $0.8 billion of held for sale, which was down 30%, margin 15%, down 813 basis points year on year. So peer-to-peer total payment volume, that's PayPal, Venmo, and Zoom, spelled with an X, was $97 billion. That was up 4%, which is about 25% of total payment volume. Venmo's total payment volume was $68 billion, up 7%. Venmo is their app that competes with Cash App in America, because they have awful bank transfer systems. They don't actually have any kind of live bank transfer system that we have. Venmo and Cash App and things like that actually do quicker payment systems, which is incredible that they've been allowed to take market share. But anyway, PayPal branded checkout, total payment volume was up only 6%, and it was about 30% of total payment volume. Braintree's is PayPal's unbranded version. That was actually up 32%, was about 30% of total payment volume. Cross-border trade was $47 billion, plus 9%. Total active accounts was actually down 1% to 428 million. Payment transactions was $6.3 billion, plus 11%. And transaction actives was plus 13%. So the total take rate ended up being 1.91%, which is minus 3 basis points Q on Q. And credit loss rate was 0.12%. So not too bad in terms of credit loss. And that transaction margin was about 45.4%. So revenue by geography, total revenue, $7.4 billion, as I said earlier. US revenue was $4.2 billion, plus 7%. International revenue, $3.1 billion, and that was up 10%. So growing buybacks, bottom line EPS was growing much faster than net income and top line revenues. I think that's to be expected when somebody is firing an elephant gun at their shares. In terms of guide, management said that they reckon revenue will come in at $7.4 billion next quarter, which is about 7% up. Non-GAAP EPS will be up about 10%. And for the full year, they expect non-GAAP EPS to be about plus 21%. And they reckon they'll generate about $4.6 billion in free cash flow, which actually was lowered because last quarter it was supposed to be $5 billion. New CEO, James Chris, he is ex-Intuit, and a new CFO was announced as well, Jamie Miller. She's from EY, GE, and Cargill in her history, so she's got quite a storied sort of financial past. So a few interesting bits on the call that I pulled out. There's challenges with the current business, and to be fair to the CEO, he's very honest. He's a very good talker. He's listened to what the problems are, and he lists them out in his call really well and how he wants to address them. So he looks at the moment to be quite a good appointment, but let's see how he does. So he says challenges with the current PayPal business: it's not focused, it's complex, it has poor execution, it's done too many acquisitions, has too high a cost base, and it needs to be a leaner, more efficient business. He said competition and complexity have increased and the company's focus is not clear. We must simply execute better and with higher velocity, and we will. We are not searching for ideas for tremendous growth. We know exactly what needs to be done. We simply must execute. Overall, is we have lots of opportunities, but we're doing too many things and we're spread too thin. We have a lot of acquisitions that we've done over the last few years. We have a lot of duplication and a lot of manual work that we have an opportunity to invest in automation. His top priority is small and medium businesses, which is the majority of merchant accounts. This is the first core priority I've asked teams to focus on, next for small business. The core customer problem we can solve is helping them get more customers. We serve approximately 35 million merchant accounts, and the vast majority of them are small and medium businesses. So yeah, clear and honest communication there, Steve. It's very rare that you get this kind of chat out from a CEO. He has said he needs to refocus the company, deliver on the opportunity that he believes PayPal can become. Unbranded Braintree Payments is now the fastest growing opportunity at PayPal, and I would watch if Complete Payments can revitalize PayPal's branded checkout growth. So there's lots here for Chris to do. He's looking forward to him delivering profitable growth. So just one of the things I want to say is, because a lot of times when I hear people talking about PayPal, they talk about it as a brand. You can forget talking about PayPal as a brand. The branded checkout of PayPal is not growing. It's growing slower than inflation. It's the unbranded white label, the one that people don't even know is PayPal checkout, that is growing. The total payment volume on branded checkout is growing slower than inflation. That means they're either losing total payment volume, it's going somewhere else, or it's moving across to Braintree, which is evidently what's happening here. Braintree is really, really aggressively priced. It's much cheaper than branded PayPal checkout, and thus is growing much quicker for what is essentially a very similar solution. So yeah, I think this, Steve, and I said it off air, this I had a decent week. PayPal rose a little bit off the back of this. I think the CEO is a bit of a breath of fresh air, but I think the big winner out of this, Steve, was Adyen, because a lot of people sat and looked at this PayPal report and said Adyen is doing a lot better than PayPal.
I hear you on that last point. And when I zoom back out on the Adyen chart, it looks a little bit like a sort of, well, let's say it looks like an exaggerated version of my portfolio, which is, if you take it back a couple of years, or maybe even just 12 months, down and to the right, and then up quite sharply at the end, like a bit of a ski slope, basically. Generally speaking, working lower. Adyen's come down more in lumps than my portfolio has, which has been a more steady kind of working lower. But you get the general idea. Adyen had a very good week, partly as a result of PayPal's results, as you say. I'm only partly convinced by the idea that that was good news for Adyen, but it then makes it harder to start thinking about buying Adyen at that point, because you didn't buy it when it was 7% lower. Now you're going to try and buy it now the price has gone up. You feel a lot like the kind of wrong end of what you want to be here. But I also thought, by the way, that I was impressed by PayPal's new CEO. It sounds like the kind of thing where if you were interviewing for the job of PayPal CEO, and I doubt anyone interviews for the job of PayPal CEO, by the way, I imagine more they're kind of headhunted into the role. But if you were interviewing it and someone said, how would you make this company better? I would probably say, I don't know, it wouldn't be me, but I imagine I would want someone to say something along the lines of, look, I'm going to work out how to get more people onto this platform, and I'm going to work out how to get better margins out of the ones we currently do have. And that's largely what I heard. I heard a lot of stuff in there, and maybe it's because it's my kind of focus for this week in various different companies. People talking about margins left and right. I heard them talking about lots of duplication, which basically means that your acquisitions haven't integrated properly because you've got more than one thing doing the same stuff. The point of acquiring businesses, a lot of the time, or at least a big part of the point, is, well, you do this stuff, we do this stuff. If you don't have the cost of doing that, we can get more money out of your things. So you'll be more profitable with us. Very roughly is part of the thought. It doesn't work when there's no synergy between them, but that's part of the idea. Said costs are too high. Things that are currently done manual can be automated, which means probably lost jobs, but also probably lower costs. That kind of margin expanding stuff that we've seen. And that they're trying to do too much stuff at the moment means slim down and focus. So all of that sounded like margin stuff to me. There was also a bit that said, you mentioned, looking at SMEs or something, we have 35 million or whatever of them on our platform, and there's more of them to go and get. So there is kind of top line growth to be potentially had there if they can find a way to do it through either their branded checkout or through Braintree. If stuff is moving across to Braintree, I view that as a margin headwind. I assume the kind of white label, lower cost to user stuff can only be lower margin to PayPal here. And they've very much gone in the direction that if you think you are a branded product, is not the direction that you're quote unquote supposed to go in. Realistically, we're not going to talk about it. We're 53 minutes gone. So I'll say Kraft Heinz has gone the opposite direction, basically. They're looking to protect their brands, push their prices, maintain their margins. PayPal appears to be kind of trying to grab volume here with off its branded stuff into Braintree, which is a lower margin for them, but then sort out the margin elsewhere in the business by pulling costs out and doing things more efficiently and properly and so on. So I thought this was a pretty encouraging thing. If the idea is Adyen's currently doing it better, that's almost certainly true. PayPal looks like it's been on a huge grab to try and fend off all of its competitors by either acquiring them or just spreading itself out to get itself in everywhere, rather than working on building out the quality of its own offering and looking after its quote-unquote brand, such as it was. So it doesn't look to me like a company that thinks like a branded company. It looks to me like a company that thinks like a commodity company. And that's intrinsically fine. You can still win like that. But you need to not be thinking we're going to win here by being PayPal, as it were. Steve?
Yeah, just remember on the call, Adyen told you exactly what happens when you make a load of acquisitions. He said, if you make a load of acquisitions, you end up with tons of duplication. You end up with tons of people who don't understand the previous product. You can acquire a company and half the developers leave and all your new developers don't understand how the product works or even know how to fix it when it breaks. So Adyen builds everything itself. It doesn't make acquisitions. And that's exactly what PayPal has told you here. The CEO came, he's had a look at the business, and he said, this is an absolute mess. So what he's saying here is that they're targeting small and medium businesses. That's fine, because Adyen want large, complex businesses. So he's saying here they're essentially not capable of dealing with complexity because their system is a mismatch of stuff that's been sellotaped together. So what he's basically saying is Adyen has a free run at the big businesses here because they're not going to try and compete with them. They're after small, they're after medium. That to me just makes you look at something like Adyen here and say, look, that is another competitor that has just slipped away here. So I think with Adyen calling a sort of an extra special investor day in the middle of this quarter, which in the middle of this half, sorry, which absolutely never happens, I have a feeling Adyen have some incredible news to tell you about how things are going. And I would assume it sort of coincides with PayPal dropping out of the sort of complex transactions space that Adyen primarily wants to operate in.
It's interesting. I hadn't really clocked quite looking at their sort of revenue mix by geography. You mentioned 7.4 was their kind of either payment volume or total revenue here. More than half of that coming from the US, making them look very much like a kind of internal operation. I sort of think with these companies, there is no particular reason why they all ought to be. Think of Mercado Libre or something like that as a Latin American, partly PayPal, along with partly Amazon, partly a few different other things as well, all kind of under one roof there. But I didn't realize quite how heavy US-centric they were in PayPal, because that is a company that it's not a company we just read about, basically. It's a company that we see and use and so on in everyday-ish transactions, and not just because we buy a load of stuff online from the US, but we do that as well. I'm sort of interested in that because I kind of think that I guess your domestic market is where you feel like you want to be and have to be winning. But equally, this kind of business ought to travel, at least I think anyway.
I think the problem is there's a lot of competition in Europe. There's probably not as much in America.
I mean, there won't be now. PayPal busy bought them all.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, bought them all, sellotaped it all together, and created a monster. But Steve, I think we've got time for one more. Do you want to do Kraft, or do you want me to do Four Corners?
No, you talk about Four Corners.
Okay. So this is, as I said earlier, it's a stock that I've been buying again this month. It's a REIT that we have discussed before on the podcast. They're primarily in Olive Gardens, to be honest. They're quite heavily exposed to Darden restaurants. The Olive Garden chain is a very, very popular restaurant sandwich breadstick chain in America, but they have a number of other companies as well. So we're maybe being a bit blasé about their portfolio, but I think it's going to prove to be quite recession resistant if recession comes along, because I think these sort of companies are the companies that people will continue to go to, and that they will be able to continue to pay their rents. Obviously, being a REIT, that's very important. But earnings was out this week. They were not very well covered because it's just a $2 billion REIT. It's not a big REIT. But I'll give you a quick rundown of what happened. So rental revenue for the third quarter, it was 17.3% up year over year to $57.2 million. Rental revenue consisted of $56.1 million in cash rents and $1.2 million in straight line / non-cash rent adjustments. Net income attributable to common shareholders, $24.2 million for the third quarter. It's about 27 cents per diluted share. These results compare to net income attributable to common shareholders of $24.5 million for the same quarter in the prior year, or 30 cents per diluted share, which will tell you something about how much they have been diluting to be aggressive this year. Four Corners Property Trust has received rent payments representing about 99.9% of its portfolio contractual base rent for the quarter, so doing well on collections. Net income attributable to common shareholders was $70.9 million for the 9 months ended at the end of September, and that was about 80 cents per diluted share, and these results compare to $74.9 million for the same nine-month period in 2022, or 92 cents per diluted share. In terms of FFO, FFO was up 1 cent to 41 cent year on year, and FFO of $1.20 was flat year on year for the first three quarters. So Bill was pretty prevalent on call. He said basically that they've been making record acquisitions. So he said, and I quote, through the first three quarters, Four Corners Property Trust has achieved record acquisition growth this year, up 13% over 2022 total volume, funded through accretive capital raised earlier in the year. Additionally, our portfolio continued to perform well with high rent collections and occupancy. We believe that we are well positioned in this higher rate environment and expect to be ready to take advantage of more opportunities as they arise. In terms of leases and lease lengths, they have 1,106 properties located in 47 states, and the properties are 99.8% occupied under long-term net leases that have a weighted average lease time of approximately 8 years. During the third quarter, they acquired 31 properties. They spent $130.2 million, an average weighted cash yield of 6.4%. On rents in place as of the end of September, and these had a weighted average remaining lease term of 12.1 years. Some dispositions: they sold a couple of properties for about 11.2 million. That was a 0.3 million pound dollar gain, cash yield of about 6.7%. They declared a dividend, Steve, of about 34 cents. It's a funny number; it doesn't quite make 34 cents. It rounds up to that though. And that's per common share. And that will be in the third quarter of 2023. So yeah, it's one I own. I think it's hard to deny it's been a pretty meh performer. Even when you include the dividend, it was rightly pointed out to me that on the 5-year chart, this one has been a pretty poor performer. You'd only be mildly positive if you included the dividend. I think it's a pretty tough time to judge a REIT though, Steve. I think it's kind of, there's a lot of people who do this. They'll wait for growth stocks to hit the very bottom and they'll say growth stocks are crap. Look at this on a 5-year chart. There's been a lot of fear and flight from REITs this year, even the good ones. And I actually think this is a good one, Steve. I think management is very good. I've said that on a number of occasions. So I've bought this week twice on two occasions, thanks to Webull. Steve, is this one that you're interested in at all?
Yeah, it is. I also like REITs at the moment. I've been saying for a few months now, actually, and I think it was probably true a few months ago that I quite liked REITs. Certainly since around May or so, I've been thinking that property prices have been coming lower. REIT prices have been either foreshadowing or responding to the value of their assets falling, but rental demand in a lot of cases doesn't seem to be going anywhere. People routinely, and I think with some justification, make the point about what we might call commercial real estate, by which they mean offices, maybe seeing some downturn in demand here. But there are plenty of REITs in my, as far as I can tell, where that kind of demand destruction isn't happening. And one of them is probably the restaurant space. You made the point about Darden. Four Corners is pretty upfront about the fact that Darden restaurants, especially Olive Gardens, do kind of dominate their portfolio. There's two ways you can look at that, and I think they do look at it the right way, which is that we would like a more diversified tenant base. We would also like a high-quality tenant base. Darden are a good tenant. They're unlikely to pay. And if they take up, I don't know how much it is now, 30-something percent of your portfolio maybe, well, that's 30-something percent of your rent that you're very unlikely to not get. I feel the same way about, in a slightly more exaggerated fashion, primary health properties, to be honest. They leased 90-odd percent of their stuff to the NHS. That's pretty undiversified, but the NHS are much less likely to default on rent than anybody else. The question comes down to, well, how much do you want to be exposing yourself to other companies and their potential default risks? Restaurants, I don't think, are in decline, especially not the kind that they're looking at, which is mostly kind of quick survey stuff. I think Burger King, they have quite a few restaurants that are occupied by them. They come and they go, but there will always be demand for these sorts of things. I'm not convinced I view this as a kind of omni-channel retailing, by the way, which is to say you can either go in and buy the thing, or you can buy the thing kind of online through, in this country, Deliveroo. I know they're not really in this country, but over there, various other Uber Eats type apps, and have someone deliver the thing to you. So they are they're kind of part warehouse, part shop, as I see it. And I don't think that method of delivery is going to change anytime soon. So I don't think this is in danger from the rise of e-commerce or the rise of automation or anything like that. I'm fairly optimistic for rents and occupancy in this sector going forward for some way. I can imagine a world where someone like Burger King says, look, we're just going to set up like a big Burger King industrial factory kitchen thing, and everyone who orders online will just ship it out of that thing rather than running a retail operation. I'm not sure that's immediately on the cards here, and I think they would still keep their restaurants anyway, because I think the reason they would do that would be to take demand off their restaurants. There's never going to be a shortage of footfall in Olive Gardens and that kind of thing. Recession resistant, yeah, probably. Restaurants do tend to be a bit cyclical, but low cost ones hold up better than higher cost ones. I think you might find people kind of trading into those a little bit. Flattish growth doesn't surprise me. With a REIT, I think the thing to do here is not go looking for huge growth, although interesting that they're looking to be aggressive, printing shares and using them to go and make acquisitions. The way these things work, you mentioned there's been both acquisitions and disposals. It sounded about right to me, to be honest, with the kind of ambition is to borrow money at one price, go and invest it at something that gives you a better rate of return than the one that you paid out on, keep the spread, and at the end of it, sell something to go and pay down the debt. So and keep the money you made in between. That's a perfectly legitimate kind of way of going about doing business here, and assuming they borrowed via stock, didn't they, in this case. So dividend yield there is 6% at the moment. If you assume they printed slightly higher than that, call it just under 6%, so they're getting a 6.4% return on the stuff that they've just bought in. There's money to be made there. There's a 12-year average lease on them, so that pushes them out longer. They've disposed of some stuff, paid off presumably what was an old debt there that had come due. That's the way you operate if you're in the REIT space. You buy properties, make money off them, sell them then when the debt comes due, or do something else to raise the kind of cash for it. What you're looking for here, I think, is stability rather than spectacular growth. What you are seeing is stability. Take the growth opportunities where they come.
Absolutely, yeah. This is just a way to keep getting cash into the portfolio. So you want this stock to appreciate by 2-3% and to keep growing at that kind of speed, and then to pay out a hefty dividend on top of that to make up the difference between the S&P return and what you get from Four Corners. One of the things Bill always is keen to point out is that you think about your own town or where you live. Even if a restaurant business is to go bust, it's very rare that a different type of business ends up being inside that unit. So even if you have Wimpy's or something like that, and it goes bust, the very likelihood is the next company that goes into that will be also a burger chain of some description. And it's because recreating that space or changing that space to something else is very, very expensive. So units tend to stay the same unit for the whole time they are in existence. So just to say, Darden actually makes up about 51% last time I checked of theirs. So it's a mix of Olive Garden and Longhorn Steakhouse. They're the two mm-hmm. big ones, and then it's a mixture of all the other stuff of Darden's that are less known. I think it's Cheddar's and is it Capital Grill or something like that. Bahama Breeze is one I seem to remember. But yeah, so 51% of their rent is pretty heavily secured in Darden, which is a strong profitable company. You can buy that one on the stock market if you wanted to. But yeah, I think it's a pretty impressive business. I'm really happy with my position at the moment.
You should be. I think the REITs in general, it's maybe something we make as much hay out of. They are companies where ordinarily we say, well, look, there's what the share price is doing and what the business is doing. And those two things can come quite dramatically apart for a period of weeks or months or even years, arguably in some cases. In the case of Four Corners plus a bunch of other REITs as well, they are in a better position as a business when their share price is higher. It makes their cost of capital go down. So where I was saying, look, you want to kind of get money, borrow money or raise equity at one price and then go invest in it at a different price. If your share price is higher, it means that effectively what you pay for equity is you pay the dividend away to your new shareholders. So if your share price goes up, your dividend yield goes down, your cost of raising capital becomes lower in this case. So you are actually in a better position here. It's that little upturn that they saw towards the end of the week, maybe after their results, maybe after some news about interest rates and so on, that will be helping these companies, not just raising their share price. So sometimes you want to kind of reassess thinking, the share price has gone up, but the business hasn't really changed very much. In this case, if the share price goes up, the business does change quite significantly. It has better opportunities if it's in a position and has the desire to go and take advantage of them, which it sounds like Four Corners is the kind of REIT that does that sort of thing.
I mean, early in the year, the share price of this was about $26, which is about where Four Corners has been sort of range bound for the last 5 years. I mean, forget COVID, it fell to about 13, but everything did. It rebounded pretty quickly up to nearly 30. So selling at 25, 26 for somebody like Four Corners is exactly what they would expect to be doing. At the moment, Steve, it went as low as $20, and I think it's already back up to 22 and a half. So there's still opportunity for me here. I think even for it to get stuck back in the range bound, sort of 25, 26 is buying here is a decent return.
Yeah, I'd be fascinated to know what the yield on a Darden bond is at the moment, because I think if you're 50% Darden, half of what you have is basically a Darden bond of a sort, right? I mean, they're going to pay their rent before they do anything else. Darden's not paying dividends to shareholders before it's paying its rent and so on. And if something did go wrong there, you're pretty near the front of the queue when it comes to creditors to get paid what you're owed there. So if the Darden yield on a bond for any length of time is less than 6-ish% dividend, just over 6% at the moment, I think you might have a nice kind of extra winner here of a way of getting effectively a better return with slightly less risk. I'm not interested enough, by the way, to go and look up what the yield on a Darden bond is. And there are differences as well in the Four Corners' dividend can go up and Darden's bond yield won't. But I think that's pretty much us for this show. Steve, was there anything else you wanted to add in before we say bye?
No, that was it.
Cool. Well, in that case, thank you all very much for listening. Less stock action than we thought we were going to have, but there's plenty more to come next week. I'll be kicking things off with, another REIT, one from the UK, one about food as well. If only Four Corners was a UK place, it wouldn't be this one. But anyway, that's all. Bye for now.